You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me a longtime friend, Jeff Deist. He is the president of the Mises Institute. That's an educational organization that's dedicated to promoting Austrian economics, freedom, and peace. And Jeff previously worked as a longtime advisor and chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul. He is a tax attorney, having represented high net worth individuals, partnerships, and corporations in a wide variety of tax manners. His tax career includes a time with two different big four accounting firms specializing in tax issues arising from mergers and acquisitions for private equity firms. But now he is totally immersed in his role in helping people understand why Austrian economic policies are key to peace and prosperity. Jeff is an excellent public speaker, and he frequently interviews fascinating guests at Mises.org. That's the Mises website, Mises, M-I-S-E-S.org. I strongly encourage you to go there, learn to know about what the Austrian School of Economics is all about, if you're not already familiar with it. But even if you are, go there, because there's just an ongoing, a lot of good interviews and articles and so forth that are displayed there. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks a million, Jay. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while, and I should mention also that people can follow you on Twitter at Jeff Deist, at Jeff, J-E-F-F-D-E-I-S-T. Jeff, I'd like to start out by asking you a question that Adam Taggart frequently asks his guests on his Wealthion interviews, and that is this. What is your current assessment of today's global economy and financial markets?
Shaky, Jay. Shaky like the San Andreas Fault. How's that?
Well, I shouldn't be laughing.
Here's the thing is we need a corrective. That's the problem with the Bidens of the world, the Yellens of the world, the Jerome Powells of the world. They think that their job is to prevent a recession. That's not their job. Their job is not to manage the economy. The economy will manage itself just fine. The problem is that by trying to manage the economy on both the fiscal side and the monetary side, there's two different sides, they end up creating bubbles, in my opinion, and those bubbles need to deflate. In other words, the recession is the cure. The thing we're trying to avoid
is the cure.
Is like taking your vitamins or eating your broccoli or taking your antibiotic. It's the cure. It's necessary to expose and wipe out all the bad debt, all the malinvestment. And so the more we try to beat off the recession, the more we just prolong things and in some cases even pass them on to future generations. So it's a serious problem.
It's a serious problem, no doubt about that. It seems to me, Jeff, that these aren't people that necessarily mean evil. They don't mean to do us harm. I think they're just, we've all been taught Keynesian economics in our economics 101 classes. That's the only economic school of thought. Do you know of hardly any universities anywhere that teach the Austrian School of Economics, which is really a free market, government hands off, central banks hands off of the economy and let people be free to trade and rise or fall by their own successes or failures. Can you maybe just give a brief definition of Keynesian economic theory and perhaps contrast that with Austrian school thought?
I think the biggest difference is the emphasis on production versus consumption. I mean, at the end of the day, John Maynard Keynes comes along with this general theory in the 1930s and really creates an upheaval and in many ways upends a lot of what we thought was true from the classical Adam Smith or now neoclassical school of economics. So basically, ever since then, for almost 100 years now, but certainly since the 1930s, the entire profession of economics and politics to a lesser extent has been in bed with this idea that, well, we got to create demand, Jay. We got to stimulate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got to create demand and make people buy more stuff. because consumption drives an economy. And of course, we know that that's absolute nonsense. First of all, we all want more stuff. That's innate in us as humans, is to have more and bigger and better. We don't have to stimulate that. What we have to do to get more stuff is actually become more productive, both on our, in our personal lives, but also on a, in a macro sense. So a long time ago, Jean-Baptiste Say, the French economist, came up with Say's Law, which in effect we might say, no pun intended, is that production creates consumption. In other words, as an individual or as a society, how much you produce is generally going to determine your income and thus your ability to consume. So we have to get the horse before the cart. The horse is production. So how do you get a more productive society? Well, both businesses and individuals have to be profitable, which means they have to bring in more income than they spend. They have to save or invest the difference, and that savings and investment has to go into creating more productive ways of bringing goods and services to the marketplace, right? That's, I mean, this isn't rocket science, folks, but instead we have this mania that if we create lots of money and credit, and we've certainly done that in response to COVID, holy smokes, about $6 trillion just on the fiscal side. Forget the Fed, folks.
Yeah.
Just on the fiscal side, Congress, just in the United States, put about $6 trillion right into the economy, into companies, PPP loans, into state and local governments, into individual taxpayers' bank accounts, into corporate subsidies, into the balance sheet of airlines, you name it. I mean, that's $6 trillion in actual spendable cash that's out there sloshing around. And so we wonder why there's price inflation? That's absurd, Jay.
Yeah, and if you encourage consumption and discourage production, you know, it's not hard to understand, is it? But that's so we've been told, though, for a long time, Jeff, and it seems as though, you know, we haven't had – this is a mainstream thought. We haven't had an inflation problem until now. Now, all of a sudden, they say now we have inflation. Maybe you could give us the definition of the Austrian schools, the Austrian school definition of inflation, for example, because I don't think it matches up with the common – thought of what inflation is or what you hear on the news media every day.
Yeah, it really is something that all these Johnny come latelys are suddenly talking about inflation, from Time magazine to pop stars to, you know, the whole thing's just absurd. I mean, look, first of all, inflation's a policy. It's not something that just comes along and happens like the weather changes or somebody gets cancer. No, no, no. Inflation is a policy. Okay. It's predictable, it's foreseeable. Second of all, inflation is, yes, as Milton Friedman said, a monetary phenomenon, but that's not the whole story. Inflation is a monetary devaluation, okay? Just like anything else, there's supply and demand for money. So a pair of Levi's jeans today, maybe $45, $50, it's actually cheaper in real terms than a pair of Levi's jeans in the 1970s, okay? There's a lot more money today. So how do we explain that? Well, supply and demand. Right. I mean, there are factors bigger than monetary policy at work. And we do not subscribe to the so-called quantity theory of money, which simply says that, you know, the more money in circulation, the higher prices. It depends. Each good and service is distinctive. Right. The demand for a DVD player today and the supply, it's not the same as it was in 1990. Right. A DVD player. Right. Nobody wants one now. You can barely give them away. So supply and demand are always operative. The question is, what would prices be absent all the monetary interventions? That's the question, and that's unknowable because we had the monetary intervention. So it is a purposeful devaluation of the currency by creating more of it. So all things equal in supply and demand, if we could freeze the economy and people still wanted DVD players, for example, you know, if you create a bunch more money in credit and that's chasing the same number of DVD players. I mean, you know, that's, you can create money and credit faster than the DVD industry can create a bunch of new players. So yes, all things equal, the quantity theory of money suggests that the more of it there is, the less each dollar is worth. And that's exceedingly true even when we have this exorbitant privilege of being the world's reserve currency. So the whole world needs dollars to clear international transactions and to buy oil in many cases. The world needs dollars more than it otherwise would were it not for Bretton Woods and our military power and OPEC and all kinds of geopolitical reasons. But it still doesn't matter. It still doesn't matter is that when you create a lot more money and credit, and you haven't had, that doesn't mean, that does not bring any new goods or services into existence.
No,
I don't
no.
don't understand why this is so difficult for people. You mm-hmm. money and credit's not what makes us rich. More goods and services brought to market in a more affordable, which is say more productive manner, that's what makes us better off.
Yeah, so out of the Great Depression, I guess Keynes thought that he wasn't seeing anybody buy anything, so he wanted to stimulate demand. So I guess that's the inflation policy that you're talking about. To stimulate demand, you put money in people's hands. That's the idea, to get them to buy things. But if you don't have something on the other side of the equation, the production, and we've seen this, haven't we, Jeff, in spades with the COVID, and now, of course, supply chain disruptions, not only from COVID, but as a result of the war. So we're seeing this massive increase in demand that's created by artificial means, money going into the system, but we don't have the supply side rising at the same rate of speed. The quantity theory of money, then that's the monetarist, that's Milton Friedman, right? That's his view.
Yes, basically that you adjust the supply of money on the monetary side like a dial. That on a, you know, like a volume dial on a stereo, mm-hmm. and you turn it up or down depending on the needs of the economy. And of course, mm-hmm. I think that's nonsense. I think money can produce itself and provide itself, and the quantity demanded or sought can be determined by the marketplace. But that's a mm-hmm. long way from the system we've got.
Right. I think the monetarists generally tend to be free market people, except for money. And I suppose that's one reason why a lot of Republicans tend to identify with the monetarist, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. All right. So we have this this whole money going into the system, the ability to create money. I just have to ask you, why do you think we've got the Keynesians and it's the only school, it's the only thought in town? Well, not quite. The Mises Institute. And a few other people here and there that are letting people know that, you know, free market economics actually do work if people are free. The government puts its thumb on the scale by printing money. Money is available to whatever it wants, the government wants to direct it towards. But is there some reason why, I guess what I'm wanting to ask you is, why do you think it is that only Keynesian economics is taught in universities? Why aren't we free to hear some other sides of some other thoughts?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have an excellent answer for that. I think first and foremost, there's an atavistic, natural human tendency, the desire to want to control things around us, mm-hmm. our environment. Mm-hmm. And when you get into big modern governments, they want to control everything from housing to energy to food to money. Why wouldn't they, mm-hmm. right? That's the nature of government, to grow and expand and try to assert itself over an ever-widening turf. So that's very human. And we also, I think it's very human to seek order out of chaos. And so we mm-hmm. like to imagine that someone is steering the ship and that mm-hmm. they're these really smart guys. And they are smart. Alan Greenspan, mm-hmm. Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, Jerome Powell, they're very smart. You know, that mm-hmm. there's these smart people who know more than us and went to Wharton or someplace, mm-hmm. and they're going to figure this out and take care of us and have our interests at heart, you know. And that's, I think there's a lot of that. That's very appealing to people on a political basis, right? The mm-hmm. idea that adults are in charge. I think we mm-hmm. all want that to be the case, but it isn't the case. And so whether we like it or not, we have, I think, responsibility to take a look at the monetary system and figure it out and try to understand what's going on so that we don't absolutely ruin our kids and grandkids. And we are ruining them, Jay. They have, mm-hmm. they're far less optimistic than we were at their age. They have less money than we did at their age. They are married and owning homes at much lower rates than we were at their age. Mm-hmm. And most importantly is they're just generally less hopeful and more pessimistic. I mean, when I was a young guy in the 80s, for example, I thought my future was going to be pretty bright. And yet the only mm-hmm. real worries we had was, you know, they had some ups and downs. There was that recession in the 80s. You had the Soviets and their nuclear weapons. But for the most part, we more or less thought that we were going to do as well or better than our parents unless we screwed up our lives somehow on a personal level. And when we lose that, I mean, you know, monetary policy, fiscal policy, all these things can be dealt with if we have the heart, if we have the stones, if we have the will. But if we mm-hmm. lose that, Jay, mm-hmm. then we're just not Americans at that point.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the world's reserve currency and the advantages. that that has. I wonder if it's not also a curse because it has allowed us to run these huge deficits, these huge debts. In the meantime, China has been a net exporter. It's built up foreign currency reserves, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of foreign currency reserves. And I'm wondering, in terms of understanding the monetary system, I have to ask your thoughts about Putin's recent moves after, you know, his currency sunk. It just went straight down after he went into the Ukraine. But then he increased the interest rates from 9.5% to 20%, I believe. That was his first move to try to steady the ruble. Mm. And then very shortly after that, on March 25th, he tied gold to, I think it was 500 rubles to a gram of gold, some number like that. And then right after that, he told all the unfriendly countries that wanted to buy his natural gas, they're going to have to pay him in rubles, much as the United States did, Kissinger did, after we went off the gold standard, sort of putting something real under the money, under the ruble. And the ruble's been the strongest currency in the world since then, I think, or one of the strongest anyway since then. Any thoughts about that? Do you think there's any chance? Alistair MacLeod talks about this sort of thing on our show frequently. Do you see any sort of chance that maybe someone might wake up and realize that we need to have something real underlying, some intrinsic value per unit of currency?
Yeah, isn't that something? You take a son of a bitch like Putin, at least he's a son of a bitch in the interests of his own people, you know?
Yeah.
And what's so scary about this terrible war, of course, is that not America so much, but a lot of the developing world is so reliant on wheat exports coming out of that part of the world and fertilizer. Even America is pretty dependent on fertilizer. Ukraine's a big export of fertilizer, and now they're cut off from coastal access if they're even able to produce while they're getting bombed and all that. So that's scary. I do think that the East, let's call Russia the East in this conversation, China, India. I do think that people there have more of a sense of having something back up. The currency gold is still a huge cultural issue in places like India. It's still given as a dowry. People still tend to own a lot of it. In other words, any place where people haven't been so fat and happy on fiat currencies for decades, they tend to view things a little more clear-eyed and say, hey, you know, we need something with real value. Mm-hmm. And oil has real value. Wheat has real value. And so if gold has real value. And so if you underlie the ruble with those things, it probably helps the ruble. If only we could do that here.
Yeah. Well, what are the chances? I mean, I guess nobody's thinking in those terms now, as long as things work. I mean, why wouldn't you continue to do what you, if you can run a counterfeit currency, why not do it, Jeff? You know, you can, but here's the thing. I have to ask you about this because we've seen, there's a website called WTF Happened in 1971. I don't know if you've seen that or not. But from 1971, yes, it's an inflection point, and everything has gone downhill in terms of an egalitarian, let's say, a society that is paid for what it produces, as opposed to, you know, what you know instead of who you know, or what you do instead of, you know. So I'm just wondering, the whole idea of how we went from a very egalitarian society in which, yeah, the people at the top of a corporation did very well, but so did the people in the middle. And we had you and I both come from Ohio. We know what the world was like. I'm a little older than you, but I remember when times were really quite good in Canton, Ohio. Industry was booming. With just a couple of minutes left here, maybe thoughts on that?
Well, it is true that ever since we abandoned gold, the U.S. economy has been hollowed out in many ways. And more importantly, it's become possible for Congress to live beyond its means. I don't know why. Well, I wonder sometimes why such a ready market exists for our treasuries. If I were, let's say, a foreign person or a foreign creditor, I would look at the United States Congress and say, these guys are insane. They're never going to get their fiscal house in order. If I'm going to loan them money, I need junk bond rates. But yet here we are with even 10 years just above 3%. So that just shows you Uncle Sam is still the least dirty shirt in the laundry, I guess.
Well, I think that's the only reason. And of course, liquidity issues and so on and so forth. But there is a sense among a lot of people that this game may be coming to an end, or at least ready to change fairly dramatically. Jeff, we'll have to leave it go at that. We're out of time, but I would like to tell people to go to themises.org, partake of a lot of great information there. Jeff provides a lot of things. He does a lot of interviews. There's a lot of great articles there. It's not fluff. It's real, and sometimes you have to work a little harder to get to the truth and understand it, but I think it's well worth your time to go to Mises.org and avail yourselves to that. Thank you so much, Jeff, for being with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Next week, the man who flew his airplane under the Eiffel Tower, Bob Moriarty, will be with me, and Michael Spreadborough, he's the CEO of Noble Resources, he'll join me to talk about that company's future. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.